It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
One of the recurring themes on this show is I continually revisit the issues between men and women. And you've heard me say this often, the Bible gets accused frequently of being a patriarchal, chauvinistic book. And as I've often said, the Bible does come out of a patriarchal culture, but there are a lot of egalitarian teachings in the Bible. For one thing, it says that in the church, there's neither male nor female. Now, they're not talking about transgender type issues. They're talking about the fact that your status is not different if you were a woman. But in that society, your status was lower if you were a woman. So that passage alone, and there are many others. There are all kinds of listings of women who were prophets, such as Moses' sister and Philip's seven daughters. Prophet is listed as one of the five authoritative offices, positions of authority in the church. So it goes on and on, but occasionally we do see an unusual passage of scripture. And I'm reading today from the New International Version, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, starting with verse 4 and going to verse 6. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, and every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is just as though her head were shaved. If a woman does not cover her head, she should have her hair cut off, and if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or shaved, she should cover her head. Now, you need to know that when we find these bizarre, obscure passages of Scripture, and I don't mean to demean the Bible because I think the Bible's just being misunderstood. When the Bible's taken out of context, it can be made to mean anything. That means the biblical context of the verses before and after it. And remember, there were no chapter or verse divisions originally. It also means the cultural context. But whatever unusual passage we mean, there's always going to be a church someplace that takes it literally. So there are churches which tell women that if they do not cover their heads, they're not going to be admitted. But is this what the passage is really saying? Actually, the Greek in that passage, and this was originally written in Greek, can be translated more than one way. Now, you don't have to be a scholar to understand that. You don't even have to read Greek. If you have a copy of the New International Version, and I have had some issues with that translation, but I want to compliment them today, because one thing I appreciate about them is when they choose to translate a verse a certain way, if it could possibly be translated in another way, they will say so in the footnotes and the margins. If you see the term or, that means it could be translated another way. Sometimes there are different copies of Greek manuscripts that are saying different things, but if that's the case, they'll say some manuscripts read. When you see the word or, that means there's agreement that this Greek is in the manuscript correctly, but there's disagreement as to how to translate it. And sometimes the way the NIV chooses to translate it and what they choose they'll put in the main narrative, as I said, is something that I disagree with. In this particular case, I agree more with what's in the margins. Now look at the alternate way that this could be translated. Every man who prays or prophesies with long hair dishonors his head. See, they're not even talking about head coverings or scarves or hats. And every woman who prays or prophesies with no covering of hair on her head dishonors her head. She is just like one of the shorn women. If a woman has no covering, let her be for now with short hair. But since it is a disgrace for a woman to have hair shorn or shaved, she should grow it again. And so in that alternative translation, they're saying men should not have long hair, women should not have short hair. Now, I understand that what's considered long and what's considered short changes changes every generation. When the Beatles first appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show in the early 60s, they looked like girls because their hair was so long. Men didn't wear their hair that long in those days. Although back in the 1800s, men in America did wear their hair that way, and they were considered very masculine. And by the late 60s, men had hair down to their shoulders, and the Beatles looked like they had short haircuts. So I understand it changes. The point, though, is whatever length of hair a culture would view as masculine or feminine, women should not try to look like men. Men should not try to look like women. Now, with all that's going on today with LGBTQ, I realize this is something a lot of people don't want to hear, but this is exactly what the Bible is telling us. A woman or a man should not present themselves in a way that contradicts their sexuality, the way they were born. Now, what do you do when there are two different ways to translate the Greek? Well, we could toss a coin, or there is a better way. The rule of thumb, the objective rule of thumb, and you really couldn't get more objective than this, is to ask yourself which alternative translation fits the context better. Well, here's what's interesting. You go a few verses down, verse 15 of the same chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians. It says, "For long hair is given to her as a covering." Now, that particular passage of Greek has no dispute about the way to translate it. The scholars are all agreed that it should translate that way. So they're saying right there, her hair is her covering, not some veil, not some scarf, not some headdress. That settles the issue. But going back to the original concern, is this some kind of demeaning view of women? Well, the men are being rebuked just as much. No, women shouldn't make themselves look like men by having short hair, but men shouldn't make themselves look like women by having long hair. So there's nothing here that's elevating men over women. Paul's handing it out quite equally. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to talk about my latest book, The Many Myths About Ministry. As you know, I'm a Christian apologist, but let me tell you something. In my many years of interactions with skeptics, doubters, and even seekers, I have found that the vast majority of their problems with Christianity stem from previous church experiences. Yes, what's more, many of their concerns are valid and serve as inspiration for this book. While defending the truth of the Bible and the importance of the gospel message, I nevertheless take an honest look at the way Christians interact with each other. From the larger issues of putting our leaders on too high a pedestal, to the unfair judging of the way another person worships, to the unsolicited advice which claims to have been led by the Spirit of God. Of course, and I do believe this Spirit of God speaks, I do, but a lot of times Christians are putting words in his mouth. Who are we kidding? My friends, this simple, easy read will strike a chord of familiarity with anyone involved in church life. It's a call to lay aside the unimportant issues that distract us and return to the heart of Christian community.
The Many Myths About Ministry by Bob Siegel, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Royce, welcome to the Bob Siegel Show.
Yes, Bob. Once I asked a practicing medical physician to tell me in his best and most concise words, what does a doctor do? And he answered, we study healthy people in healthy organs. And so in light of that, I was wondering, what does a Christian apologist do, and what gives you the confidence to enter the public square to be a Christian apologist?
Well, I think you're asking a really good question, Royce, and I appreciate it. A Christian apologist is one who believes that people don't have to throw their brains out the window to be religious.
Okay.
I believe that the existence of God can be defended scientifically. I believe the rationale and logic of the existence of a supreme being can be defended philosophically. I believe, this is very important, that the resurrection of Jesus can be defended historically by eyewitnesses and historians even outside of the Bible, and that many of the events in even the Old Testament can be defended archaeologically. So that on so many levels, I believe that when we read the Bible, we're reading a historical documentation of true, not blind faith, but true interaction from God. And that is what a Christian apologist does. We are people that reason it out. Now, I do believe that if the Spirit of God doesn't do a work in somebody's heart, that none of the reasoning in the world's going to make any difference. But at the same time, people do ask reasonable questions, and they're entitled to reasonable answers. The phrase apologist was first coined in the second century when ancient Rome was accusing Christians of things that they weren't really doing, and also accusing them of being anti-intellectual. And so the early apologists, men like Justin Martyr, defended the facts of Christianity, that Christ's resurrection from the dead was cataloged. It was in the archives of Pontius Pilate. Any Roman emperor could check the archives at any time, read Pilate's own report, even Pilate's report that he had risen from the dead, a report so convincing that even Emperor Tiberius was overwhelmed by it and wanted to classify Jesus as a god through the Roman Senate. But they also defended Christianity morally and made it clear to the emperors that they were not really enemies of Rome. Let me give you a chance to respond, but that's my definition of what an apologist does.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And one other question, just a follow-up question. When did you decide, or did you decide, were you kind of like the ugly duckling that didn't know that that it was a swan until you saw a swan? And I was just curious about, how did you become an apologist?
I was raised in a very liberal Jewish family, which meant that we were Jews culturally, but not religiously. My parents were actually atheists, and I knew nothing about Judaism, Christianity, or any other religion. In my second year of college, I had a mystical encounter with the Spirit of Christ that just knocked my socks off, and for want of better words, I actually met God. Nothing short of that would have convinced me. And because my orientation to this was not having been brought up in the church, because I came in, Royce, through a back door, so to speak, because on a Monday I did not believe, and on a Tuesday it wasn't even a matter of believing it, I knew for a fact that it was true. Apologetics just got right into my blood.
And
so this was one way of defending it was, well, you can meet the Spirit of God and find out for yourself. Another way of defending it is, well, if you're not open to even receiving the Spirit of God, then check some of the historical evidence. So it made me interested in everything from fulfilled prophecy to archaeology to history to everything.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Bob.
Thanks for listening, Royce. I appreciate it. Call us again sometime.
All right.
Okay. Take care.
Bob Siegel not only writes fiction, but nonfiction as well. Over the years, Bob has received wonderful comments about his book on Christian apologetics entitled, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Many have put this book in the hands of their seeking, unbelieving friends, and the book takes it from there. This is because the book has a rhetorical skeptic that argues with Bob about the harder, less frequently discussed questions. As a result, the reader is immediately aware that they are reading from an author who relates to them. The moment they find themselves questioning something they see, their very question appears in the text. Every question in this book was one that was personally put to Bob during his many years of speaking on college campuses. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church.
Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? Why does the Bible call premarital sex a sin? How will God judge the people who never heard of Jesus? These are but some of the critical concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob Siegel tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book will be enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
We have Lorene from San Jose, California. How are you doing, Lorene?
Doing fine. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind today?
Well, sometimes when I get in discussions with friends, they'll say things to me like, you know, but Christianity is really negative. It's a negative kind of faith. I mean, people are sinners. They have to come up to an impossible standard. And I'm a good person just because I make mistakes. I don't see why that makes me a sinner. And what's wrong with the way I am? What's wrong with the way most people are?
Right.
God loves us, so what's the deal?
Okay, well, first of all, when we get into such conversations, I think it's always good to find a place where we might agree first. And first of all, Christians, at least Christians today, and this is probably true of Christians in any day, do have a tendency to be very negative. And Christianity is supposed to be a positive message. Gospel means good news. Now, unfortunately, because the good news is that we can be forgiven of our sin, if people don't think that sin is an issue and they don't think they need forgiveness, then it doesn't sound like good news. It sounds like judgmental news. So the way I like to put it, the gospel has an evil twin brother. The good news has an evil twin brother called the bad news. And if people don't understand the bad news, they won't understand the good. Now, part of the problem with the word sin, Lorene, is it's such an archaic word, and people don't really know what it means. But the Bible defines the word sin as selfishness. In the 7th chapter of Matthew, Jesus said that the summary of following God's law was to treat people in an unselfish way. It's what we commonly call the golden rule. Treat other people as you want to be treated. Well, if sin is defined in the Bible as breaking God's laws, which it is, and if God's law is summarized in treating people unselfishly, we then have a good workable definition for sin, selfishness. And I think you'll find that if you use the word selfishness rather than sin, people can relate to it better. When people think of sin, they think, oh, you mean what, smoking, drinking, partying, having sex, some of those things the Bible condemns. The Bible doesn't condemn, on the other hand, everything that people think is a sin. So that is where I would start. Does that make sense?
It does. And I kind of try to take their approach at saying, well, do you think I'm a negative person, or am I treating you negatively? And they say, oh, no, but you're my friend.
That's a very excellent point, because you're really giving them a personal illustration and saying, well, give me an example. And by being their friend, in a sense, you've earned the right to be heard. And they know that you're not treating them like some guy standing on the street corner yelling and screaming about hellfire and brimstone and handing out tracts. So that gives you a lot of credibility. But as for it being a negative message, I know I get into conversations with people who say, yeah, I think Christianity's behind the times. And I go, well, the message of Christianity is that we as human beings have this selfish nature. And when carried to its extreme, it's the reason we have war, crime, racism, bloodshed. Do you see any evidence that the world has outgrown those things? And of course, all we have to do is follow what's been happening in the news, not just the last few years, but the last hundreds of years. And we see examples of this sin. Now, the part about being a good person, this is where the church also blows it at times. They talk as though there's absolutely nothing good in us. It is true that we have a sin nature that is hostile to God, and that we're born with this sin nature. It's also true, though, that God has given us a conscience. And in the conscience is this commentary, this running commentary on the way human beings interact. This golden rule of Jesus to treat people unselfishly is right in our conscience. I like to point out then to people that there's really no standard in the Bible that your own conscience wouldn't verify. And at that point, they realize, okay, yeah, part of me is good. That's great. That's fantastic. But I'm certainly not obeying my conscience 100% of the time. And the way I would put it to them is, do you obey your conscience as often as your own conscience is telling you you should? You see, then it's not between them and the Bible or them and God so much as them and their own conscience. Of course, that comes from God. What do you think?
Well, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense, because that way, really, when a person's conscience bothers them, it's nobody else pointing a finger at them.
Exactly. Well, Lorene, it sounds to me like you're doing a great job. It sounds like you're breaking the mold and not fitting the stereotype Christian to them. So the very fact that they're even talking with you about it says lots.
Well, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.